The following programming is sponsored by
MBC Media.
The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And a Statue of
Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly. And good afternoon, Philadelphia. Welcome back to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860. This is your host, Gary Heasley, and I'm in the studio with Ada, Nestor. Ada?
Again, here we are.
Here we go. Going to be an interesting second hour. Now, there was a news item that you mentioned just a second ago, and we're going to get to this in a minute, but can you just give us the 10-second update on that news item?
So Broad and Liberty broke a story this morning that, based on explosive emails, I'm reading a tweet here, guys, it was just sent to me. Explosive emails reveal deep coordination and funding ties between Philadelphia DA, Larry Krasner, PACs, which are political action committees, and radical consultants, raising serious questions about ethics, campaign law, and criminal justice.
Now, we had the candidate that's running against Larry Krasner on the air. We would have had Krasner on, too. But we had this gentleman named Pat Dugan on, who's running against Larry Krasner.
We're going to have him again, right?
He's going to be back. Yeah. I think it's October 10, but stay tuned. Pay attention to our flyers, and you'll know when he's coming on. But this could be an earth-shattering kind of thing in this little race for the prosecuting attorney, district attorney of Philadelphia, which, as you know, has been a role that was used to make the city far less safe. And I mean, it's been a disaster down here. But I will tell you, in Philadelphia, Krasner has tremendous support among people. And the Philadelphia Inquirer, one of the most, I think, effective Democrat PACs, has done a great job of making him sound like he's a hero. So we'll come back to this story, and we're going to have Pat Dugan on, so we'll get his reaction to it when we do that show in a couple of weeks. But what I want to shift to now, you know, we were talking earlier about Donald Trump being at the United Nations. And when he was at the United Nations, he made a few comments that I thought were great. Not just, I mean, we can't play them all. We could play Donald Trump clips for this whole 2 hours if we wanted to. But I want to play one clip right now, which is clip three. Shane, can we play clip three? Oh, it's coming up here in a second. And go ahead. Yeah.
According to the Council of Europe in 2024, almost 50% of inmates in German prisons were foreign nationals or migrants. In Austria, the number was 53% of the people in prisons were from places that weren't from where they are now. In Greece, the number was 54%. And in Switzerland, beautiful Switzerland, 72% of the people in prisons are from outside of Switzerland. When your prisons are filled with so-called asylum seekers who repaid kindness, and that's what they did, they repaid kindness with crime, it's time to end the failed experiment of open borders. You have to end it now.
So, you know, here you've got Europe that's facing the same kind of invasion we've faced. They've been facing it for a long time. And one nation that has been particularly affected is Ireland. And we've been reading about Ireland. We've been talking about Ireland, but we haven't actually talked to Ireland. And so we thought today we would get a guest on who is on the ground in Ireland and can tell us exactly what's actually happening there. So we want to welcome to the Conservative Voice Peter Connolly. From I believe, Dublin. Peter, welcome to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia.
Gary, how you doing? Good afternoon.
Good evening. Yeah. For you, right?
Right.
Well, it's good evening for me. Yeah. Good afternoon for you, is it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
So nice to have you join us. And you heard the comments that Donald Trump made at the UN, you know, we've been talking about Germany and Greece. We've been talking about what's happened in Paris and London, and it's been really like watching some of these nations and great cities be overrun. At least that's what it appears to be from here in the United States, and from some folks that have been traveling in those cities. Can you tell us what is the real circumstance on the ground in Ireland relative to what I call an invasion?
Okay, I suppose where we see the situation beginning to really escalate has been since, I mean, if let's go back a little bit, but say since 2004, when the European Union opened its borders, and the first kind of influx that we would have seen was we saw a lot of people coming in, say, from the Eastern European countries, Poland, places like this. But this didn't, you know, how would we say, people of similar backgrounds, you know, I mean, at one stage with the census that we would carry out, say, every number of years, I think it was 2014, with the amount of people that came in. But as to how that reflected, that the second language in Ireland at that stage was Polish.
Polish.
So that Polish was the second language. Yeah, that was what was recorded. But I mean, that these were people that came in, you know, kind of similar background, similar outlook. They integrated, you mm-hmm. know, there was no kind of trouble or, you know, that, you know, and you know, I didn't see the kind of reaction that you would get out from what we're seeing today. But what happened then, I suppose, for me, in terms of how I look at it, is that if you look at in March of 22, we had the start of the war in Ukraine. And I think we took a figure of somewhere maybe between 90 and 110,000 Ukrainians into this country. Now, to put it in context, Ireland, in terms of the population at the moment, is around 5.2 million. But I figure, and it's difficult to try and get these figures, but we're still probably, based on birth rates and stuff like that, we're hovering around 3.5 million that are actually Irish. Now, the Irish people were very welcoming in relation, you know, they wanted to do what they did in relation to mm-hmm. Ukraine. And a lot of villages were very, you know, and towns and all of the rest around the country were, you know, look, hey, look, we take some of the Ukrainians and that kind of thing. But what we then saw was busloads of people that were coming in. And I'll give one little kind of piece to this.
Mm-hmm.
When the people were leaving from Ukraine, one of the things that swung into place straight away was a presidential order, in the sense that it was men aged between, I think it was 18 to 60 years of age, could not leave the country. So it's men. So who you predominantly would have seen on the flights and that kind of thing coming in, it was women, it was the elderly. If it was males, they were below the age of 18 and they were above the age of 60.
Mm-hmm.
But then what we start to see is this massive influx of men that are coming in. They're not from Ukraine. They're definitely not from Ukraine.
Yep.
And they're particularly, you know, around that age of, similar to what has happened with some of the examination of kind of demographics that we mentioned, Germany. So men aged between 25 to 35.
Yep.
I'll just say one thing and then look at guys if you want to come in. But so in Germany, a number of years ago, there was a particular professor of mathematics or statistics or something that he highlighted that in Germany, that roughly, say, at the time, there was about 82 million.
Mm-hmm.
And if we looked at the figures, say, of the ethnic element of German males aged between 25 and 35, it was somewhere maybe around 5.5 million. And then they're saying, well, you know, so the simple reaction would be to say, oh, well, you know, what's wrong with taking in a million a year? Sure, look, we've 82, like we could take in another million.
Mm-hmm.
When you've only got 5 million that are ethnic male aged between 25 to 35, and you're bringing in a million a year, but the significance of that 25 to 35 is that they would be the, some may argue differently, but they would be the fathers of the next generation. And in kind of a perilous type time, they would be the fighting age male.
That's right. And so, yeah. I mean, just thinking of these numbers, I mean, you're saying 3.5 million are Irish, 5.2 million resident. That's one third of your population, of the population of Ireland, is not Irish. There's no chance that that doesn't change the cultural makeup of a country. That's going to change the country dramatically.
And you're right. What we're seeing, not just in Ireland, but across Europe and in America for 4 years, we were told that we need to be open our borders to allow these people to come in because they deserve a better life and borders don't matter anymore. And that it was families and women and children who needed this help and support in our nations. But it has been military age single men or at least men coming alone, military age, across all of our borders, everywhere.
Yes.
That's what we're seeing. We're seeing military age men.
Coming alone, and we were told these are families seeking a better life.
Yeah.
Well, you're not supposed to be migrating on economics, right? So seeking a better life, well, then it's, well, they're asylum seekers. They're facing the risk of death. Wait a minute.
So
you're,
am I.
You're telling me.
Really?
You're telling me that 20 million people have to come to the United States because they're facing, they got a problem in their home country, has to get fixed then.
Yeah.
But so Peter, when you're, how is life on the streets of the streets of Ireland? You know, how have things changed, especially in the smaller villages that have been effectively overrun? How have things changed for the Irish people?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's been a number of examples of kind of small towns and that kind of thing who were opening their doors and opening their arms on the basis that there were, you know, there was refugees that were coming in. And so, you know, overnight, like if you had a town that maybe had a population of 400 or 500 residents, only a small little town, and then you've got, you know, 600 people that were brought in, or, you know, 400 people that were brought in overnight. You can see how that's going to change things. But also, you know, the proportions of what we see in relation to a town and how the demographics are broken down. So just when I mentioned that demographic, like Germany, for example, if you take a town known as Athlone, which is in the center of Ireland. Now, when I last looked at this, that has a population of somewhere around, say, 23,000. And if you do the same extrapolation from what we've done with looking at the census figures, I may stand corrected, but my observation on it is that you've got a male population of 25 to 35 there, maybe somewhere in the region of, say, 2,500 to 4,000 men. Now, that reflects in different, you know, obviously jobs, labor force, and you know, for other things that are going on in terms of the, you know, doctors. If it was the family case in relation to things like schools and that kind of thing, but to have, say, a male population of 25 to 35, and you've got 2,500, and then all of a sudden they're bringing in, you know, they bring in 1,000 or whatever. You could see the impact that that could potentially have on a town like that. And that, you know, I've looked at this in terms of different towns, you know, and you can extrapolate the figures a little bit differently, like, or similar in the sense of, you know, maybe a town has, say, or and surrounding areas, 18,000, 23,000, et cetera, that type of thing. But to bring in a figure of like 1,000 or more into an area where we know what the male demographic is. So the potential for these guys, even if they are coming in and it's all the best will in the world, jobs, maybe places for study, or it just hasn't. And then, of course, the result of what we're seeing as well. Now, remember, when we're talking about people coming into the country, we've got a legal and we also have an illegal route in terms of how people are coming. And bear in mind that we're very closely connected with the United Kingdom. Sitting into the north of our country is Northern Ireland, where people can, you know, fly in, or they can take a boat or whatever, and then they can just take a taxi or a train straight down into Dublin. So this is part of this. But quite simply, you know, we're seeing a number of things. With we're seeing an escalation, a major escalation in crime. We're seeing the resources are not there. We're seeing that the you know, there's a major issue now, and this is both legal and illegal, as I said, as to how people are coming in. But say, for example, with property, it just isn't the places to house everybody, or that they can react at an increased rate to deliver the number of properties that are required.
You know, you think about the way immigration has been used in the United States for 3-4 decades outside of Trump's first term. The way wages were falling, meaning that wages that were increasing maybe 2% a year in a market where inflation was 3% a year, your wages are actually going down effectively by 1% a year. Your ability to buy things is reduced, right? And so for three decades, we saw wages go down. And that was a direct result of a bunch of things, but the most important things were bringing in unskilled labor, but not just unskilled labor. They brought in semi-skilled and skilled labor as well, using illegally using H-1B visas to make sure they could bring in say, tech workers that would be willing and able to work for less than an American could work for. This was used specifically by corporations and their representatives in our government, which is pretty much all of them, to make sure that the American people did not prosper. And the middle class has been put under a tremendous amount of pressure. And what you're talking about is from 2004, when the borders were open, to 14, when the polls came but tried to integrate. That's what you said. Well, if you go back to the days of the industrialization of the United States, and there were a few periods where we had surges in immigration, but those people who came from Wales and from Italy and from Lebanon, they came in and specifically tried to integrate. They taught their children. The Chinese, you know, weren't allowed to speak Chinese outside the home. They spoke English, and they specifically tried to integrate. They went into the workplaces, and they went into the schools, and they made their children American so they could prosper in this great nation that they put all the time and trouble into moving to. What we see in the modern era is certainly not that. What we see now is that this evil, racist United States has to conform to the needs of everyone from everywhere, because while our culture is boring and bland, their cultures are exotic and vibrant, and they're characterized as these superior cultures. Well, I will tell you, if you look at issues from slavery to just prosperity, freedom, property rights, the first real opportunity for average people to live in peace, prosperity, safety, and security, to be free, has been Western civilization. So I don't think all cultures are equal. I think Western civilization is far superior to everything else, and I reject wholeheartedly the idea that we have to cast aside our culture and embrace these others because they're somehow better.
Assimilation was required for citizenship for a reason. There was a reason that we required assimilation into our society, because once you assimilate, you are protective of it. You embrace it. You work to, you know, continue on the American dream, and you're a part of it. We completely lost that.
Well, and we had here the wonderful advantage of having all these cultures. You could go and find, you know, music and
yes,
food and you know, festivals and things that highlighted some of these cultures, and that made it interesting and fun.
Yeah.
But at the core, we were Americans. And at the core, people came to America to be Americans. And that's just not the case. And it sounds like in Ireland, you may be starting to face that same reality, that people who come don't come with an intention of integration, but rather they may believe that they're going to come and convert Ireland to their way of life.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've witnessed recently, just in relation to a school, and this would be kind of, you know, say, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds just starting out in school. Now, this is just, I would reiterate this again, this is just my own opinion and mm-hmm. observation. But what I was led to believe was that I saw my own children obviously are you know, English speakers and that type of thing, but I was watching the interaction in the class, and I've been watching this for a while, and they're not going to tell me this, but I'm led to believe that primarily in that class there are not too many people, I think, that are actually fluent English speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore the children are, you know, either, you know, as to how they, so we're being told all of these ideas or these mantras that they continually trying to bring upon us, that things like, you know, diversity is our strength and all this type of thing. But I've never witnessed this before. They're actually looking at a class there, and so the nature of it is that the English is not their primary language. When they come to school in the morning, they have to make the switch, and they're not speaking English at home. And so, I mean, I even saw this recently with another school where they were saying, oh, you know, we have a separate thing here for, you know, the children coming in, and we try to bring them up to speed with English. But these are some of the things that we're seeing. So, you know, there's not even within any society a commonality of a language. And that's one of the things that is obvious. Now, you were saying there about percentages and stuff like that, and so I figured that where I live, and I'm living here in South Dublin, that in certain areas here, it is greater than 50% are not from Ireland.
Wow.
And, as to how that, it's difficult to see that at this stage, like, you know, to kind of truly understand what's going on. Like, I give an example of the languages as a first thing. But, and as to how people are, for me, certainly, you know, with that, you know, there has to be some sort of way that people are going to come into the society and they're going to integrate and that kind of thing. Otherwise, we're just, there's other problems that are, you know, will manifest over a period of time. Dare I say, like, even that things begin to manifest in some sort of ways, like what we've seen in Sweden with,
yes,
the want of war ghettos and that type of thing, you know?
Yeah. Let me make this local. Pennsylvania schools now have 209 languages spoken. 3.1% of that is Russian. They've got Nepali. They've got Mandarin, Ukrainian. So 209 languages spoken. Now, in the Pennsylvania schools as a whole, about 6% of the students are English learners. So that number it's a big number, but it's not maybe unmanageable. In the Philadelphia school system, 21% of the students are English learners. One in five Philadelphia students is not fluent in English. Now, if you could imagine the challenge of trying to manage through that in education, it is a significant challenge. So what happens? Who pays for this? Well, who pays for this is the students who aren't getting the attention and resources they need to learn, as we call it, reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Which we see the numbers declining across the state of Pennsylvania in those fields directly.
Well, absolutely we see it. Because if you look at, let's stick to Philadelphia for just a minute, just to give those numbers. English language proficiency is 34%. Math is 22%. That's a 5.5% improvement over to the 23-24 year. And science is 40%. That's a 3.3% improvement versus 21-22. So we're talking just 23-4. 34% of the students are not proficient. Are proficient in English. 22% are proficient in math, and 40% in science.
Which means the other percentage are not. Which means they are not operating on grade level. They are not getting the education they are legally required and deserving of, so that we can continue on this path.
2/3 not proficient in English. 78% not proficient in math. 60% not proficient in science.
Yep.
I don't know how you get science higher proficiency than math, but that's a mystery of the way they do the numbers. So we're seeing the students in Philadelphia schools and in Pennsylvania schools pay the price for this mass migration, which has sucked a huge amount of resources, time, and focus away from teaching them the critical things they need to succeed in life, and rather invest those in this huge population of people who were brought here on purpose to invade this country. And now, look, I don't hate immigrants, and I don't hate anybody.
No, I love immigrants.
These numbers are simply unacceptable, and this is not the way you manage a country for the benefit of its residents and citizens. This nation is supposed to be organized to benefit its people, not to allow corporations to get better wage rates and to allow politicians to get money from somebody, and to allow the UN to implement its 17 agenda goals here in Philadelphia schools. So I think what we're seeing is very similar to what you are seeing.
On a bigger scale, I think, in Ireland.
Yeah, and we've only got about 6 minutes left, Peter. So my question for you is, what is the path forward for Ireland? How can Ireland be saved and remain Ireland?
Well, sorry, can you still hear me? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, sorry. So I just quickly, while we have just a few minutes left, I'll just try and run through some. I want the listeners just to get some idea. And this may or may not be relevant, but I do believe that it's relevant in the sense of who wrote this, and this would be something similar to what you refer to as the founding fathers. So how Ireland comes about, and maybe you're familiar with the date, which is for us would be 1916, and we had the proclamation that came out that was read at that time. And so there's a very important piece in it, and I'll just read it quickly. It just says only one or two lines. It says, "We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland, and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies to be sovereign and indefeasible. The long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not extinguished the right, and nor can it ever be extinguished except by the destruction of the Irish people. And so what I'm seeing at the moment is that I have reason to believe, and we don't really have time, but there is a milestone that took place for us, which is back in 2008 with the economic crisis. And I think that part of what we're looking at the moment is where we're coming out this far side of what happened in 2008 with deaths and that type of thing that were foisted onto this country. That we're now into a situation where I think that in some sort of ways, what I have reason to believe, and this is just an opinion,
mm-hmm.
and it's like as if I'm looking at this from a ship out at sea, looking at Ireland with a pair of binoculars and trying to decipher what's going on. But I figure that this country has changed hands and it is under new ownership. And that new ownership, if we were to look at that, as to whether that was done back in 2008 as somebody looking at their asset register,
mm-hmm.
because we had the Lisbon Treaty for the European Union signed in December of 2007. 3 months later, this country is bankrupt. And I figure that as to whether we're looking at, there is reason to believe that there is a change of ownership. And what we're seeing at the moment, even with some of the rhetoric that is coming in through the media and that type of thing about, things like, the Irish is not really a nationality or they're not really a people. And this is some of this rhetoric, to be quite honest with you, is scary when we look at it historically as to how people use such rhetoric.
Yes.
I believe that at this stage that it has gone too far. And as to how we could talk of any form or shape of recovery. We just saw recently an economic deal signed between Ireland and India. You might ask yourself, what's that all about?
Mm-hmm.
Direct flights, et cetera. We're seeing the same thing now in the UK with the number of direct flights being set up with various different countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think for ourselves and for those as well in the UK, I think it's a change of hands at this stage. I think the Irish are, as to how they can, even understand that what it is exactly that they're losing or that they have lost.
Is there a migration element to this trade deal with India?
There is. We see huge numbers of Indians coming into the country legally. We are seeing trade pacts being signed with India. I have to verify that, but even the proposal of some ghastly number to be allowed to come and study in Ireland. Now, this is just kind of one last point. For the professional classes in this country, once people have gone through the university system,
mm-hmm.
now they can take those particular professional jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The things like accountancy and doctors and engineers and that type of thing. And isn't that fantastic now that maybe that people have come through our university system but can be employed for, maybe less or,
I think the number is about 40% less.
That's the way.
So it happens here two ways.
That would be, I think.
Yeah. So they're doing the same thing here. We've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of students in universities that are being trained. Now, many of them now go home. They didn't used to. Everyone used to try to stay. Now many of them go home, but many, many of them stay here. And so they join the workforce, and that brings in much more labor supply, which helps suppress wages. But we also have this thing called H-1B visas, where a corporation can argue that they can't find American workers to do jobs. And we're told constantly that American workers don't want to do any jobs.
Yep.
Apparently they just stop, right? So they have these H-1Bs, but they use them to replace existing workers. Disney, this formerly revered company, actually brought in it had to be a decade ago now. They brought in 200 people, actually from India in that case, to take tech jobs from Americans working at Disney in Florida, and the Americans were told you can either get severance by training your replacement,
yep,
or you leave now with no severance. Now, they ended up suing, and a few years later, they got a settlement out of Disney, but that didn't change the fact that those jobs were gone, and that the whole purpose of that wasn't that Americans couldn't do the job or wouldn't do the job, but rather they could bring folks in from a foreign country to get them to do the job for significantly less. And I think the number was 40%, but don't quote me on that. So what you're seeing in Ireland is exactly what we're seeing in the United States. What you're seeing in Irish schools is what we're seeing in the Philadelphia schools and Pennsylvania schools as a whole, although much greater impact in Philadelphia. And our nations are on the same course, and it is the same globalist actors behind the scenes that are pushing these levers. Now, Americans don't yet feel the nation is lost. They still think, you know, somehow these people are going to integrate. And of course, you see Americans out attacking our immigration enforcement agencies for deporting foreigners, people that are not U.S. citizens who are here illegally, sending them home. You've got American citizens protesting that violently.
With the shooting this week in Dallas at the Dallas ICE office.
Yeah.
And he shot indiscriminately, and unfortunately, he hit migrants who were being removed.
But now you got this violence because these people have been so programmed. I'm talking about the Americans have been so programmed to believe that somehow we owe it to these folks that are coming from all over the world to bring them here, to pay for their hotel for a year or something, to give them apartments, to give them housing, training, give them jobs. We owe it to them. And this is, oddly enough, mostly people that are older, like people that are, say, call it 55 to 75.
How odd.
That have been so trained in this way. Now, their kids are screaming because they can't find work.
Knock it off.
Well, Peter, I appreciate you calling in. I enjoyed our conversation a couple of days ago, and I'm glad that you were able to relay this. We'll post a couple of these things in our social media, that the trade deal and the declaration. The proclamation of the Irish Republic was read in front of the General Post Office in Dublin at 12:45 p.m. on Easter Monday, 24th April, 1916. That's when it was said that Ireland belongs to the Irish.
Yeah.
And you may be right. It may be that it no longer does. But thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we'll have another conversation dig in a little deeper and kind of keep track of what's happening over there.
Guys, thanks very much for having me on. Great experience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of your Friday night.
Yeah, it's yes. Thank you. You know, I would love to take a quick trip to Ireland. I know some folks are going to be there shortly, and it's a beautiful country. But
let's go.
You know,
reporting on the streets, reporting from Ireland. Yeah. I think we should. Why not?
And I think we have to ask ourselves, why is it that the people of Ireland, the people of the United States, the people of the UK, the people of Germany, why is it they have not defended their nations? And I can't answer that.
You know what? I can. I can't give you an answer as to why, but I can tell you that we see the exact same thing here. Where are the men, guys? I am tired of having to go to these meetings, whether in person or virtually, and listen to women defending our values, to women standing up or calling in and taking the brunt of the abuse from our community while the men sit silent.